Welcome to In Social Work, the podcast series of the University of Buffalo School of Social Work at www.insocialwork.org. We're glad you could join us today. The purpose of In Social Work is to engage practitioners and researchers in lifelong learning and to promote research to practice and practice to research. We educate, we connect, we care. We're in social work.
Hi from Buffalo. It's been a snowy winter here so far, but in true Western New York fashion, it's made for excellent skiing and boarding at our three, within a one-hour drive, ski resorts. I'm Peter Sabota. Few would argue that numerous dynamics and daily practice issues can wear on the resolve of health and human service professionals. In this episode, our guest, Ellen Fink-Samnick, describes the professional resilience paradigm. Ms. Fink-Samnick frames professional resilience by describing a defined set of building blocks and a list of very practical strategies to promote resilience. Her entire conversation emphasizes the necessity that helping professionals of all disciplines take ownership for the development and realization of their personal and professional goals. Ellen Fink-Samnick is the owner of EFS Supervision Strategies and adjunct faculty member at the George Mason University Social Work Department. She is a popular presenter, mentor, and consultant, as well as the author of a number of publications. Ms. Fink-Samnick was interviewed by Stephen Schwartz, and Steve interviewed Ellen in November of 2014.
Today we have the great privilege and honor to have with us Ellen Fink-Samnick, who is a social worker and, among other things, a alumna of the University of Buffalo School of Social Work here. Good morning.
Good morning, Steve.
You're going to be talking to us today about fostering professional resilience, an area that you really are expertise in. Maybe a good place to start is for you to remind us how you got interested in the issue of resilience for social workers.
I'd be glad to. It's an interesting place to begin because it actually started almost 20 years after I had gotten my master's degree in social work from the University of Buffalo. And I was at what I thought to be the absolute height, the absolute pinnacle of my professional career. I was a director of case management at a hospital in Northern Virginia and just working long, tough hours, challenging situations. And really at the height of my game was starting to give my first presentations, was starting to write my very first articles. And life was busy, along with a 14 to 16 hour day. I was president of a professional association for the second time, the glutton for punishment that sometimes we do to ourselves in the industry, and had a wonderful new marriage that I was hoping would flourish because I really wanted this one to work, and had a great supply of friends that every day we do the high flyby sort of thing. Had a stepson, which he is wonderful and now 28, but at that point he was a freshman in college, and we would do the one-word text messages, hi, bye, alive, send dollars. Life for me was like spinning around a track and going and going and going and just not ever stopping. Usually people, when I say that to them, will be shaking their heads. So I would imagine that many who are listening to this podcast at this point are going, yeah, I know that world, Ellen. I live it every day. Because of how busy and active it was, of course, there were a few other situations in my life that seemed to be spinning rapidly out of control. My parents, who were living in New York at the time, suddenly my mother called me with that call that no child ever likes to get. Dad's had a stroke. You need to come home. So what did I, the daughter, the social worker, the one that knew every nook and cranny of the healthcare system, do? I changed my hours at the hospital. I readjusted to a four-day work week so I could drive back and forth between my home in Northern Virginia and where my parents were on Long Island so that I could help them sell their house, help my parents close my father's practice, and transition them to a new life, which would be in Northern Virginia. And they were going to be living with me for a short period of time. Along with that, as we know, what happens to us when we get stressed beyond our max, whether we are aware of it or not, a medical condition I had been dealing with for some time decided to rear its ugly head, and I suddenly found out I needed surgery and would be out of the hospital, my home away from home where I worked, for 10 weeks. And that was going to be a challenge for everybody because I was the one keeping everyone together. During those 10 weeks, I had lots of visits from friends, and one in particular who came in the house and brought me the one thing that she said I would never buy myself, which was an Oprah magazine. And while I had nothing against Oprah, I was so busy, it was so chaotic, and I barely had enough time to go to the bathroom, let alone look at an Oprah magazine. But when she brought that one in, I had had my fill of Lifetime TV, was ready to tear my hair out, and really needed something to focus on. And the magazine had a mission of the month. I believe it still does. And the mission that month said, protect your time, it is your life. And I thought, okay, my friend's trying to get my attention. This is purposeful. And as I opened the magazine up, it said, what I know for sure is that how one spends their time defines who they are. And what suddenly poured through my head, Steve, was all of the meetings and all of the interactions I was having with colleagues where I was just starting to see how worn, torn, and tired they were. I started to feel like, wow, this must be an occupational hazard that all of us in the social work and also in the other allied health and human services that I worked with in nursing and pharmacy and physical therapy and the physicians, that we cared for others so very much more than and often instead of ourselves, and that there was so much talk about how to improve quality for patients that I realized, wait, how can we do this if the workforce is so worn, torn, and tired that maybe if we started with them, maybe if we could create a more resilient workforce, that would in turn render a quality healthcare environment for the patients who relied on us so very much.
Well, it's very good that you can attribute and credit Oprah for some of the stimulation. Now, the professional resilience paradigm that you've developed, it wasn't just for social workers.
Correct. Because I had been working in the hospital healthcare arena, along with the social workers who were my valued colleagues, there were nurses who were part of the professional case management workforce that I had joined. There were physicians. There were respiratory therapists, nutritionists. It was the whole, as I call it, a transdisciplinary workforce that we work so closely, shoulder to shoulder with each other, and at times really held each other up. And I felt that I needed to pay homage, if you will, and create something that spoke to all of my kind of comrades in arms as we face the front lines of the care process.
And I know you're paradigm has three components. Maybe a good place to start with the first is, can you give us a definition?
Absolutely. When I wrote the professional resilience paradigm, what was clear was there needed to be a distinct definition for resilience. We were really starting to see the beginnings of resilience appearing everywhere in the literature. And it was so focused on workforce development for organizations. After 9/11, in fact, there were a number of businesses that were created whose mantra was, we are going to make you more resilient to face the unknown challenges that exist out there. And so as I talked with my editor at the time, she said, well, you can write something unique. You can write a definition that really speaks to the health and human services workforce overall. So it became known as a professional resilience, which was very different. And the definition read, health and human service professionals' commitment to achieve balance amid the occupational stressors and life challenges while fostering professional values and career sustainability. And let me give you an example, Steve. I could say to you, Steve, okay, poof, you need to be more resilient. You need to focus on yourself. And you'll go, yeah, sure. What does Ellen know about it? Ellen's in her reality, I'm in mine. And unless you were in a place that you could really commit to making some changes in how you viewed your practice and your day, no change would occur.
Well, that's a good place for you to begin to explain to us both the building blocks and then afterwards the strategies that would be helpful to me.
Certainly. Well, part two of the paradigm were six very specific building blocks, and I kind of viewed them as the foundation, the template, as you will, almost maybe six distinct pillars. Let me go through them one by one. The first one involves promoting that sense of physical and psychological self-care. I think most people out there, you know how to maximize your self-care. You know how to eat well, get sleep, hopefully take a vacation, even if it's a long weekend. You know how to laugh once a day, enjoy your life, maybe get a regular medical checkup annually. But it was much more than that. It presented to me that this was but the tip of the iceberg for people. And that led me to number two, which is that along with promoting physical and psychological self-care, folks needed to make sure they could maintain a foundation of inner strength. And certainly we talk from a religious sense and we talk from a spiritual sense, but that's different for everybody. And being aware of that in this process is critical to knowing how to promote your professional resilience. Number three and four sort of go together. I think one builds on the other. Number three is about defining your personal as well as your professional value. And it's much more than you go into a job interview. And prior to that interview, you make that list of, you know, what your value is to the organization, because that's the big interview question that they often prepare us for. What value will you bring to this organization? What things are make up Steve that are different from Ellen or anybody else? And we're very good at being able to kind of identify those things and define them for ourselves and what's important to us. But then what happens over the long term? You have to be able to stay motivated to continue to identify the personal and professional goals you have as they change, and they will change through your career, whether it's more than just that first-year annual appraisal that you do, whether it goes on as you do a five-year check on your life or you where you want to be. Number five is about believing in the need for self-advocacy, particularly social workers. And I was seeing this with my nurse colleagues as well. My goodness, we do a phenomenal job at advocating for others. That is part of our codes of ethics and our standards of practice. However, we forget that we also need to advocate for ourselves within our job roles, our organizations, as well as our lives. And the paradigm provides some guidance on how to do that. And then we get to number six, that knowing that one through five together, when you look at them in a comprehensive way and remember them, can work to foster and enhance your career satisfaction and longevity. Because one of the things that I was hearing is that an increasing number of professionals across the health and human service disciplines were hitting the escape button on their career and maybe lasting 1, 2, maybe 3 years, if that much, before they say, you know what, I wasn't educated for this, I wasn't prepared for how tough the industry was going to be, and they were making decisions to leave the industry barely before they had finished paying off their student loans.
So what you're saying to me and others is we need to take care of ourselves, we need a strong foundation of our strengths, and to know what our values are, both professional and personal, in order to be able to achieve specific goals and aspirations. And we have to advocate for ourselves as well as or better than we advocate just in our job for others, and to know that these things will work. I think it's a great start, but you've got more to an action plan. You've got a lot of strategies, that will help me develop my own action plan for this professional resilience. Can you start listing them for us?
Absolutely. So I'm going to give you and anyone that's listening, Steve, a little warning. When I first wrote this model, there were six. And in fact, I know there is a very early article I wrote out there on the internet for fostering professional resilience, six simple strategies. And I look at that now because it occasionally makes it around on websites and social media sites. And I go, wow, I have 19 strategies. We've evolved. So some will resonate with folks more than others. I'd encourage everybody to make note of those. And then you can pursue the articles online as well because they continue to address them and expand on them. The first one is that very common thing, very common situation we have all found ourselves in. It involves valuing versus devaluing your professional self. Let me give you an example. You're in a meeting, and you might be sitting at a table with colleagues who you recognize are maybe in a higher position to you, and you want them to know that you respect them. So the words come out of your mouth. I know I'm just. I know I'm just the social worker. I know I'm just the nurse. I know I'm just the case manager. And those are words we need to stop saying. We need to take opportunities to educate others of the value that we bring to the process, and that value is unique based on any particular education we have, based on any specific credentialing and certifications and licensure that we advance our practice and obtain. So what I would pose is that instead you say, gee, you know, as the case manager, as the social worker, as the care coordinator, I bring some unique perspective to this process. Let me share with you how this impacts our situation. It takes the same amount of time, if not less, to say, I know I'm just, but promotes a little bit of self-advocacy, which goes a very long way to promote our expertise. Number two is about working to have positive contacts with your colleagues and your peers over a given day. Now, I know that may sound silly because obviously you don't go into your given day saying, I'm going to have the most negative contacts I can with people today. We're often dealing with many things, many people, many different types of professionals, different types of patients, clients, members, consumers, and their families, as well as students that bring with them interactions that may not exactly be positive, but I am firmly convinced that there are things that you can do, things that you consider to be more proactive, to more actively consider about your day, even questions like, gee, who do I have on my schedule today? Who will motivate me versus deplete me? How often might I end up in interactions with others who, frankly, just suck the life out of me? And what strategies can I engage to really stay in control and be proactive? One that I often give people is, for years, I would take the steps, five flights, up to my office in the hospital, and people would say, oh, Ellen, you're doing that to stay in shape. I was actually doing it, Steve, to avoid what I used to call the face. The face was a wonderful, wonderful person who worked with me on the unit that I was managing. And I would approach that unit if I took the elevator every day, which seemed easy. I'd come out of the elevator and I would meet with the face. And I would often say, oh, good morning, what's new today? And was greeted with, we have admissions. And I'd stop it, and with a very flat affect and a very negative tone. And that's not what I wanted to see first thing in the morning. And so to avoid that and provide myself an opportunity to get in control and ground and start with a bit more energy, I would avoid that, take the steps, go into my office and pull myself together, put on some great music, get pumping, get going, and I'd be off. And I really needed to put the more subjective, emotional stuff to the side that was created by the face. So that's number two.
That's a wonderful story. Thank you.
Oh, you're welcome. And it happens to all of us, often when we least expect it to. Number three involves that famous adage, oh, I can't take a break. I'm too busy. You know what? You have to take a break. We often find ourselves saying many times in a day, I can't afford to take lunch. You know what? You can't afford not to. Because what research has found is even the briefest break helps us re-energize and regain activity. To that end, my dad had a wonderful quote that really sticks in my head as I get to number four, which is about pacing yourself. He used to say, you know, Ellen, you need to slow down. The hurrier you go, the behinder you'll get. And I used to think my great and wise father came up with that one. Well, I think it was actually Benjamin Franklin, if I'm not mistaken. But we are working in such busy, chaotic atmospheres. And it really doesn't matter whether it's the healthcare environment, whether it's the educational institution, because I'm an adjunct faculty member, and I often find myself working quadruple time to get everything graded and prepare my lesson and make sure that I present with this solid presence so my students don't see me sweat. But I also have found that working faster, consistently, and chronically does not always yield greater output, and it doesn't always yield increased output. In fact, it sets us up more to make mistakes, which certainly none of us can ever afford to do. Number five is about being conscious in achieving validation. And that's where I talk about identifying and naming the various goals and aspirations you have. But it's more than that. You really need to put them out to the universe. And I know some people now may be thinking, oh, Ellen's getting all woo-woo on us. But really what I'm suggesting is that you engage in dialogues with people who can really empower you to achieve those goals and aspirations. Because if you keep them to yourself, they can very easily become the best kept secret out there. As a result, when you tell others and you really make it a priority to develop a relationship with someone, whether it's a clinical supervisor, whether it's a mentor, whether it is your partner or a peer, someone that you think can give you unconditional support, because frankly, you may be putting forth an idea for a new article, an idea for a new presentation, maybe a new program that you'd like to obtain a grant for, the timing may be off. And the person may have to give you the tough news of, you know, it's a great idea, but may not work for now. And you have to be able to take that from the person. Number six, along with that, includes the power of professional networking. My goodness, we are in the internet and cyber age. So my thought is that most people understand that we are engaging 24/7 and through cyberspace, through social media and professional networking on social media. But it's such a wonderful opportunity to keep up with new trends and keep us excited about all that is changing in the industry and expand our horizons, and people will use that to look for new opportunities. We're also a culture that is full of lifelong learners. And when I think now how my own career has evolved and changed so very much from where it began 32 years ago, which is so hard to believe that I will have graduated from UB. It's 31 and a half years, so it'll be 32 years, May of 2015. We are lifelong learners. To survive and be successful, you have to be able to embrace a sense that you will learn for a lifetime. Number seven is about presenting with a presence. And I think people will be listening to this interview thinking, wow, this is an underlying theme of the whole model. And it really is. Too often we think and consider, gee, I wonder if I'm burnt out. I wonder if I have vicarious trauma. I wonder if I have compassion fatigue. Well, you know what? If you're thinking about it that much, you probably are. And I encourage professionals to kind of consider every morning as they look in the mirror, how do others see you in a given day? How does your attire, what does it say to other people? Did you not manage to iron things or pick things up at the dry cleaner so that you're wearing the same thing every day? How on edge do you feel? How kind of crispy around the edges are you? If you had the opportunity to assess and interpret your own verbal and nonverbal behaviors, what would that look like? You know, would you be wanting to see you as an educator? Would you be wanting to interact with you as a healthcare or behavioral health professional? The other thing that I put forth with this is we are tasked, and I say we as the collective health and human service industry, these days especially, your title may not be management. You may be a case manager, a care coordinator, a social worker, a behavioral health specialist, but you are viewed as a leader. You are viewed as someone who others can go to obtain expertise and guidance. That is what organizations are expecting. And so with that comes a certain amount of responsibility to present in that way. Number eight, I also tell people that they need to laugh at least one time daily. I think we know the research. It reduces stress, it promotes camaraderie, and it releases the endorphins. And along with that, years ago, people would say, you need to stop and breathe. And as I wrote number nine, yes, you need to stop to take that long, deep breath. But you don't want to breathe so much that you hyperventilate, because that can easily happen. And if you stop and think about it, as I learned from one of the docs I used to work with, we actually use the same muscles to get all tense and all wound as we do to just stop and calmly breathe. Along with that, number 10 is very critical. We have to stop and take 10. And that's different. This is when we're in the moment, when we're on the job, we have to be somewhat proactive to take the responsibility for our thought process and our insight, that great insight that we were all taught in whatever entry-level course we had, whether it was social work or nursing or some other of the allied health professions, if not education, and go, wow, I need to just take 10 seconds to process and breathe. I need to take 10 minutes because I've had a challenging interaction with someone and I'm unsure what to say or do. I need to take 10 hours because, I need that mental health day. I need to take 10 days because there's a vacation looming in my future, and without it, I'm not going to feel so resilient and so effective. And frankly, if you get to needing 10 months, well, honestly, you're going to need time for a new job. Number 11 is something that I recommend to all professionals, and that's develop a grounding list. Now, when I first wrote the model over 10 years ago, we were in a post-it note age. So everybody was grabbing post-it notes to keep a 3 to 5 item action list. But now, my goodness, we have iPhones and iPads and tablets and Blackberries and Blueberries, whatever sort of mobile device floats your boat. But it's very easy to queue up a favorite song or keep a series of pictures, if not one picture, floating in the background of someone that or something that really makes you smile or makes you happy. Put a nice aroma in your office. Maybe bring up that email that you didn't have a chance to read from your child in Australia like mine, or it might be a recipe or a joke that someone sent you. Quite frequently, people will say, gee, you know, I know exactly what makes me feel good when I'm stressed. But when we are stressed and we are in the moment, we very easily forget those things that are so much a part of us. I also like to tell people, change that list up, whether it's every quarter, every 6 months, or at least once a year, because we change. And what made us laugh at one point may be making us cry at another. So we need to take that into account. Number 12 is also along this vein. It's remembering who is in charge here, and it often feels like it's everybody else. Everybody's pulling you. Your family is pulling you one direction. Work is pulling you another direction. Some people these days have 2 or 3 jobs that pull them in assorted directions. You need to sometimes take control and just stop. stop and shift the activities. Focusing too long and hard on a specific activity can be very draining. And we sometimes focus so hard that we become enmeshed and we lose objectivity. We almost get disoriented. You have to give yourself permission to walk away from something and just stop and shift gears. Number 13 is about creative visualization. And I always challenge the professionals that I speak with that in 30 seconds they can imagine themselves in a better place. In usually less than 30 seconds, you can stop, close your eyes, think of that last vacation, think of sitting in your favorite chair by the water, think of a favorite experience that always makes you smile. Try it. Number 14 is a tough one these days. We are in the internet age. We are in the heavy-duty connection age, where just because we have access to our work email and all sorts of technology 24/7, we use it. I saw a recent study that said the average person these days works a minimum of 18 hours because they can and they will. As a result, the only time that we're not working is when we're sleeping. And there's a lot to be said for deconnecting to reconnect with the rest of your life. And I saw something very funny a few months ago where a friend actually, a real friend on Facebook, not an acquaintance, but a real friend, put on Facebook that if anybody is trying to reach me for the next 48 hours, you will not be able to do so by Facebook or any other electronic means, because my family and I are having a deconnect to reconnect weekend. I thought that was awesome. You have to give yourself some distance and enjoy and reconnect with the rest of your life. Number 15 is about how we release frustration. It's about remembering those sort of common sense lessons about primal screams, which obviously most of us can't do within the workplace because the people with the white coats will come and get us. But I also tell people they can release frustration with something called a silent meow. I'm a cat owner. I have two cats, and I have been fascinated to watch them do a silent meow. They kind of close their eyes and they open their mouth, and suddenly it is as if every pore, every muscle, they are clenching to just release every ounce of frustration. And it looks like they're going to give the loudest, mightiest roar. And then nothing comes out, and they simply kind of fall down on the floor, and you go, how could anything be that relaxed? But it's that reminder that if we just release everything, 30 seconds is all it takes. In fact, I had given a presentation to an organization, and I had occasion to speak with the director, and I said, how's everybody doing? And she said, oh, Ellen, it was great. Thanks so much for coming. Something about that silent meow thing. Funny story. So after the presentation, the staff went into the bathroom, and they were all practicing with the silent meow. And it was really effective. Unfortunately, one of the agency clients then walked in, and it was kind of an interesting moment. But it really reinforced to the staff. They were able to have a good laugh about it and just know how very important it is. Number 16 is about the importance of exercise. I am sure everybody knows about the benefits of releasing those endorphins. And I'm not suggesting to take a 30-minute exercise class amid your day, though some people will. It could be that you run up and down the steps. A lot of people these days work from home. And so I encourage them to make sure to get out of the house once a day. Make sure some people go walk a pet. Some people take a walk to a mailbox. Just get out, smell the air, and get all the cells and the components of our body moving and grooving in the right direction. Number 17 is a powerful one. It's about turning off that professional switch. It really gets me going to see how professionals often, my goodness, we wear our professions like their badges. And we are so very proud of them. I'm certainly proud of all the accomplishments I've been so fortunate to achieve over the years. But I have to remember that at the end of the workday, you need to turn off that professional switch. You need to make it a ritual. Sometimes people do the happy dance. people will say, hey, let's all get together and let's go to happy hour. Sometimes people will in the car on the way home, now that we have all sorts of audiobooks and such, they will pop on an audiobook so that they can listen to something that gets them outside of the workplace. To that end, I love the fact that I have so many colleagues and friends who are in the business. But I so value the relationships with people I have made who are not in the business. And it forces me to set limits for myself about remembering to interact with them about the other things in my life, my husband, my children, things I like to laugh about that are not work-related. I think to that end, it becomes very easy for us in the health and human services, as well as educators. I've heard this from them, that we forget that we can set limits for ourselves, that just because we have a specific knowledge base about, behavioral health, about the healthcare system, about what's important in the context of education these days in terms of how to teach courses and what courses to teach and how to prioritize objectives and goals, whenever someone asks us for help, we're right there to help them. In fact, we wear the tattoos. It's right on our head. We could be sitting in an airport and someone sits next to you and they just happen to know you're a social worker in a hospital. You're a therapist. We just need to say no. It is as tough to do that as it is when our family members, when our friends reach out to us because we have that special knowledge base, that suddenly we put in a 16-hour day and then we're on the phone with a dear friend because they need that knowledge base. But it is also okay to limit it, and I'm not suggesting we be rude and disrespectful to our friend, but we also have to be able to point them in the direction of a professional community or network that they can reach out to, who perhaps can be a bit more objective to their circumstance because it's not their best friend, or it's not their sister, or it's not their child. Number 18 is a powerful one as we get to the end. It's about remembering the professional boundaries that we are all taught. And think of Teflon. Now, I might be dating myself, but I think we still have Teflon pans out there. And so we have to stay attuned to the boundaries and remember there is so much tough stuff that we deal with. It's just there. It's an occupational hazard. There's not a magic wand that is going to help us make it all disappear, though honestly, when I first started talking about professional resilience, I used to run around with a magic wand. And I realized, as funny as it was, this was just our world. We dealt with tough clients. We dealt with tough students. We dealt with organizational politics. It was tough. And no magic wand was going to make it go away, but being proactive to the strategies and remembering about Teflon and that we had the power to not let the tough stuff stick seemed to fit here. Anticipate, let things roll off a little bit more. And I have a series of folks that I've supervised over the years that still will email me and say, gee, Ellen, I still remember Teflon, whenever I walk into a tough situation with a client. They might be yelling and screaming, it is not about me, it has nothing to do with me. They'd be doing it if I were a super social worker or a super case manager or a super educator. The student that would be yelling because unfortunately they're not happy with a grade. We have to anticipate, not take it personally, and let the tough stuff roll off.
You've given us a really sensible list of interpersonal, physical, and psychological strategies, which appear exhaustive, but wait, that was only 18. There's one more very important strategy to reinforce this model.
Yes, and it is a very important one, and it's actually one of the newest ones that periodically people who have seen the article will say, wait, that one wasn't in there. And I go, well, the only constant is change, and we continue to build a better mousetrap, if you will. And that one is about paying it forward. So pay it forward is the 19th strategy. What I mean by that one is, it's almost my mention, my homage, if you will, that we have to change the professional culture that we work in. We have to set a new tone for the professionals out there across the industry to know that they can prioritize their own needs as readily as those of their clients, their students, their patients, their families, and any others they interface with. It means recognizing that they can take accountability to manage those very present occupational hazards that are endemic to any field. And in this way, I really believe, Steve, we can create a quality workforce who can render quality care, quality efforts, quality teaching, quality health care, quality therapy. And it comes back to us. Paying it forward means sharing professional resilience and that theme with at least one other person daily. It means presenting the paradigm in your classrooms for folks who are listening, who are educators, presenting it to the new generations of health and human service professionals who are entering the field, discussing it with the professional staff you interface with as they enter the workforce, making professional resilience a priority that becomes included as part of an annual evaluation or performance appraisal. Several years ago, I was actually asked by the National Association of Social Workers to sit on a task force that was part of their delegate assembly. A delegate assembly looks at their overpowering book called Social Work Speaks. And that book looks at all of NASW's positions on various topics out there, from human trafficking to immigration to mental health. And the one area that was missing, the one critical area that was missing, was self-care. And it ultimately became professional self-care, and I'm very proud to have been part of the work group that contributed to writing the professional self-care statement and policy for the industry. And so there is an opportunity for organizations to also recognize that professional resilience and professional self-care must be a part of a performance appraisal for an individual.
Well, you've given some direction to people who teach and people who practice, but what kind of final recommendations do you have for the entire field of workers, teachers, researchers, or all other caring individuals?
Well, I've mentioned this in our dialogue. You know, the only constant is change. There is always going to be something new to challenge us, some new construct, some new population, new demographic, a new technology, a new grant, a new regulation, a new mode of care delivery. And there is so much to keep us learning and more mantra toward that lifelong learning mindset. But there's one thing that each one of us can control. There's one thing that we can each be accountable for, and that is how we respond to those changes and those situations. At the end of the day, the one thing that's constant for all of us that we have to remember is that we have to be accountable for our own practice, and that there are defined strategies to promote our ability to stay balanced amid the chaos that is swirling very rapidly around us. We need to all do the best job we can to just continuously send that mantra out to the workforce, to the organizations that hire us, and especially to the next generation of professionals yet to come down the pike.
Well, you've given us a lot. Our listeners can find more details by searching the internet for Ellen's website, for your website, or Googling the professional resilience paradigm. I want to thank you personally for reminding us how to take control of our own ability to work despite any chaos, so that we do not merely survive, but we can flourish. And I hope you can join us again in the future to share more of your insights and probably a longer list of strategies. Thank you, Ellen.
Thank you, Steve. It would be my pleasure.
You've been listening to Ellen Fink-Samnick discuss how to foster professional resilience on In Social Work.
Hi, I'm Nancy Smith, Professor and Dean of the University at Buffalo School of Social Work. Thanks for listening to our podcast. We look forward to your continued support of the series. For more information about who we are as a school, our history, our online and on-the-ground degree and continuing education programs, we invite you to visit our website at www.socialwork.buffalo.edu. And while you're there, check out our Technology and Social Work Resource Center. You'll find it under the Community Resources menu.